said.
Well, again, thanks for the invitation, and for those of you who aren't from California, welcome to California. So a lot of what I'll talk about is in the Salinas Valley, so that's a pretty good drive, just a couple hours south of San Francisco, but many hours north of here. But one of the big salad bowls of the United States. So I just wanted to talk about, unfortunately, there's not a lot of solutions right now because we're probably on the front end of tackling what farmers are going to do in response to threats to food safety. In particular, they're taking sometimes a very dim look at established conservation practices. And so lots of research needed in this area to pave a much more sustainable way for how farmers will address food safety going forward. So just a few statistics. We all know that foods of animal origin, meat, milk, eggs, poultry, and a lot of our fish and shellfish are classic food safety threats, whether it's bacterial, chemical, viral. But what's becoming increasingly clear this past decade is how common produce when consumed raw can be contaminated with a wide variety of different bacterial or microbiological threats. So we've all heard about some of the outbreaks associated with lettuce, and I'll talk about that, tomatoes, cantaloupes. A whole host of commodities are now being increasingly documented as sources of foodborne contamination. So the big questions are, of course, where are they coming from and what can the farmer do to mitigate these threats? So for California, what really elevated this issue was the 2006 spinach outbreak. And I won't go all into it, but suffice it to say it happened in late summer, early fall, and that's something to think about during the rest of my talk. But it really precipitated key questions. So this would be one landscape where we would have some type of cow-calf grazing. We might run stalkers. We'll have different wildlife habitat on one side of a fence line, and then on the other side, you would have some type of leafy green production. And so the questions that state and federal government are asking, farmer groups are asking, academics, food safety scientists, is what is the biological source? If it's salmonella, if it's E. coli 157, these types of bacterial contaminants, how do they move and how do they contact the product? And so at the top of the list, of course, are going to be domestic and wild animals. And is irrigation water contaminated? Or is it something that occurs, at least out here in California, during our Mediterranean climate? Rainfall is limited mostly to late fall, winter, very early spring. Is it due to some type of runoff? And then these contaminants, if you remember, in this lower panel, many of the outbreaks occur in late summer and fall. So if you're going to blame it on winter runoff, then this load of contaminant has to survive all spring, survive prepping the field, survive one or two crops of leafy greens, and then express itself as a nationwide epidemic. So it's hard to find where is that microbial load hiding in this landscape. So if we take a look at irrigation water, at least in western systems, depends where you are in the the state. If you're way down south in the desert, it's very much, as we've heard in the previous discussion, surface-fed from Colorado River and other sources. But in the Salinas Valley area, it's dominated by well water. So if you take a look at the industry data going back 5, 6, 8 years, large number of samples, the vast majority of water samples taken from this region of California, you find very low concentrations of generic E. coli. This isn't pathogenic E. coli. So a lot of the existing data that the industry has gathered, the produce industry, doesn't indicate that there's a big threat associated certainly with well water. But you can take this high-quality well water, impound it in a pre-irrigation reservoir for a variety of reasons, and certainly in a drought year like this, previous year, probably going forward, you've created a perfect watering hole. So if you go out there in an unfenced system and walk around this time of year and throughout the summer, you'll find a variety of different species using this and, of course, defecating around the periphery. What you see in that upper left panel, of course, is a grower who's decided to chemically treat in one response to try and drive down bacterial counts. So if you look at bacterial counts, so its most probable number, just number of bacteria per 100 mil, just a standard volume, and you look at the well water values compared to the reservoir on that same farm, you'll see that holding that water just a couple days or maybe a week before you use it, you know, tenfold to 50-fold increases the concentration. So you immediately start getting water quality degradation by holding that. Even though there's a lot of economic reasons to have these pre-irrigation reservoirs, it begins to degrade the water. So what you see farmers now doing is immediately fencing this habitat. In some cases, they'll remove it entirely to make sure that's not a cause of foodborne contamination. Some of the ideas that are being tested is whether you dewater it and let those sediments dry out before you remove those and put them back into the field. Some farmers are taking a very dim view. After a couple years, as you increase sediment in these pre-irrigation ponds or in a tailwater pond, they don't really want to put those back in the field until there's clear evidence that there aren't high bacterial loads in those sediments before you put them back in the field. So that's a good area where there needs to be much more research across the U.S. if we're going to advocate these basins as a way to capture sediments. There was a very interesting talk just earlier about looking for these critical source areas and where are the loads, phosphorus, and what are the transport mechanisms. The exact same story exists for microbiological contaminants, whether it's from livestock or wildlife. So we're always looking for who is shedding those critical foodborne pathogens and how are those transport mechanisms function with respect to a grazing or wildlife population density pattern. And are those microbiological contaminants surviving long enough to reach the water to then be transported downslope to get into a field of produce? So all of those areas, right, would take a long time to discuss. But what we're finding is over the past probably 10 years, at least in California rangeland systems, that just 3 feet, 1 meter, 6 feet, 10 feet, we saw 10-meter buffers being recommended as a minimal forest buffer in some previous talks. We get about a 2-log reduction for every meter that we have a setback in rangeland. If we put a fecal patty out there, let it naturally rain, collect the water downslope of that, it very quickly filters out the majority of the contaminants, assuming what goes subsurface doesn't make it in some return flow system and work its way downstream. So we don't believe the argument that those cattle far away from a produce field are providing a substantial threat to microbiological safety, at least in the Salinas Valley region. If you go out there and test cattle, this was a set of cow-calf operations, grabbing a fecal sample, taking it back, looking for E. coli 0157. On average, we don't find that much. And there's a lot of feedlot data out there, dairy data out there that gets broadcast across the whole livestock industry. These are operations relatively close to a produce field. And except for that herd D, you see, well, these infection levels are actually quite low. So combine that with the filtration capacity of our rangeland systems, and it's not our top suspect right now is what's causing these outbreaks. So it's a little frustrating, a project that a whole host of folks, the ARS, the university, Fish and Game, different farmers all collaborated on is, well, let's go out there and if we can find this latent microbial load in the spring or in the fall, because it needs to be big enough to cause a nationwide outbreak. So large number of soil samples taken, just to a 5-centimeter depth, and very difficult to find E. coli 0157. You can see less than 1%. So we don't see a big load sitting there in the soil surface. The produce was basically that produce growing immediately above where we took the soil sample on the bed, and we didn't find a single head of lettuce contaminated with E. coli 0157. It's about 1 in 7,000, if you ask the industry, 1 in 8,000, 1 in 10,000, which is an average, if you go out there and take random heads of lettuce prior to harvest. So it's bloody hard to find. and think, how do you get a nationwide outbreak with that type of data? And I would agree, it means it's very patchy, right? You need lots of different mechanisms to line up in a random fashion that probably create the underlying conditions for an outbreak. But if you go out there and do surveillance, bloody hard to find. Water samples, that's probably a deficient water sample, but depends where you take a water sample, you'll find it in surface water sources, and then the livestock data I showed you. So then we thought, what about wildlife that are able to move into the field? So again, working with different trapping groups and our own trapping crew, looking at a host of species that would frequent a produce field in central coastal California. Feral pigs right at the top. So there's been three studies now on feral pigs, and each of them show about 4 to 5% shedding levels with E. coli 0157, so they're tough to fence out. Those of you who fought a feral pig and like to move through these produce fields, so they may be contributing to a background rate. But again, the data is not that compelling. Unfortunately, you don't find a real smoking gun. So then you go after your small rodents that are right there in a lot of the habitat right next to the produce field or in the produce field itself, developing burrows, and very little shedding levels for E. coli 0157. Salmonella is a little bit higher, and interestingly, just taking a look at parasites, though that's not what frustrates the state and federal agencies, heavy infection levels with Cryptosporidium and Giardia, which we often think of, oh, don't drink the water up in the mountains. And these are animals trapped right there next to the produce field. So there's probably some sporadic infection being caused by these protozoal parasites in rodents that are directly defecating in the field. If you look at wildlife as a group, and you can model this statistically, there's far more food safety risk, obviously, from a group of wildlife. So seagulls, if there's maybe a 1 in 20 or 5% chance that seagulls shed salmonella, well, a group of 500 seagulls have an immensely high proportion of probability of shedding salmonella as an entire group. So that's the key question we ask ourselves is, at what density of rodents would we begin to see food safety threats and to try and target to that level? So there's probably going to be some level of wildlife control in some of these systems because the farmers are so concerned. So if you defecate in the field and you're a small animal and you don't climb up on a head of romaine lettuce like this, how does it get onto the produce? So we spiked these research fields with scat, mimicking maybe a rabbit matrix, and put in E. coli 0157 and then overhead irrigate using sort of typical standard practices for 2 hours in the morning before it gets too windy, which is common. And sure enough, in relatively close proximity to those heads of lettuce, you pick up a proportion of heads that now have E. coli 0157. So looking at the data, we spiked about 10 million, so that's a pretty high load in about a 5-gram scat that was domesticated rabbit that we constructed and then put out into the field. And you can see once you get a couple feet away, kind of makes sense, right? You can only splash so far droplets of fecal material from overhead sprinklers that you're in the safe zone. And there's actually rules on the books. Is it 5 feet radius around any scat that the farmer identifies is a no harvest zone, and you have to remove that. The challenge, as you can imagine, if you are facing a large order from Walmart or whomever, Costco, and you're harvesting late at night, how are you going to identify the scat as a farmer to remove it before that last irrigation event? So age of scat, as you would imagine, scat gets dry. If you've had the fun to watch scat age over a couple days, it obviously gets harder and is less likely to splash. So what this tells us is, you know, makes perfect sense, but we want to have data to convince the farmers. It's that last irrigation, that nocturnal fecal deposition, and then you irrigate the next morning. That's the time to put the labor out into the field and identify these threats and remove it before it splashes up on the produce. So it certainly speaks well for drip irrigation, and a lot of you could speak about the advantages of drip irrigation from other perspectives, but there's probably a food safety benefit also to drip compared to overhead. So what you're seeing farmers do, of course, is build these huge fences, and lots of concern about severing wildlife corridors from a coastal range to some of our valley ranges when you build these 8-foot, 10-foot fences, and you see rodent trapping. They won't poison it because they're worried the rodents who've ingested poison will wander into a field, die, and then be harvested with the lettuce. So it's a lot of snap traps. And in the lower panel, this farmer thought, in a riparian area where there is a lot of woody vegetation, they'll just run a bulldoze to minimize the habitat so you don't have rodents moving into the produce field. So it's something that's obviously of concern. Lots of benefits we've heard in this presentation and decades of research about vegetated buffers, and we're also in strong support of the microbiological benefits of vegetated buffers and overland flow. On the right panel, you see this farmer trying to protect and minimize habitat from the upslope compared to the downslope field, have stripped out all vegetation, and that's probably the worst thing you could argue in many cases, but that's some of the ideas that are bouncing around in the farmer community. Vegetative waterways, again, there's concern that it'll create habitat for wildlife that'll offset all of the water quality benefits. So again, areas where a lot more research needs to be done, showing if you do put in vegetation and it does improve some local wildlife habitat, that the benefits to pathogen reduction outweigh the small amount of fecal deposition. But without that data, the farmers are a little bit concerned. So this is some of the scene. This would be typical Salinas Valley, and you're probably in the springtime. They're between crops, and they've removed all vegetation to try and minimize any wildlife habitat. So you guys could go on and on about all of the different problems associated with this picture, but this is what the concern of litigation and having your farm be identified as the cause of the nationwide outbreak, that they'll go to this level. So anyway, hope that gives you a quick snapshot.